Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Ledman. I had planned to have Franklin Lam as my guest today. Oh, this has been a week of unpleasant surprises. Bad weather here, and I'm afraid bad weather where he is in Beirut. And he had problems, I believe, yesterday. He had problems today. Not snow, but the storms that were disrupting communications, telephone. He had a TV interview scheduled about 90 minutes, I believe, before this program was scheduled to air, which is right now it's 11 p.m. in Beirut. And unfortunately, because of weather, his program was delayed. So he is on air now, when he was supposed to be on radio with me. Anyway, I will reschedule him. For those who don't know Franklin, he does wonderful work. Let me just tell you briefly about him. He's a journalist. He's an author. He's director of Americans Concerned for Middle East Peace. He's also a board member of the Sabra Shatila Foundation, and he's a longtime civil rights activist. He's living in Beirut now. And he's probably on his television program talking about what he and I would have been discussing here on air. But don't have Franklin, so I'm the guest today. I'm a guest often in other programs. It's been an active week for me. I have three other interviews besides my own programs, and I'm always delighted to do it when I'm asked. Mostly radio, a little television, not in this country. I have never once been on U.S. TV, mainstream TV. Maybe somebody will make a mistake and invite me one day. It'll probably be the last mistake they made, because I don't pull my punches on this program, or if I was invited on mainstream TV, and I would have to be careful what they wanted me to come on to discuss with, and then decide, is it worth it? Or do they really know who I am and they want to invite me on to beat up on me, which I really wouldn't waste my time on. But in any event, let me just tell you a little bit. I like to concentrate on my topics and my guests, so I never really discuss my own work very much. It may come up in conversations because the things, the topics of the programs, sometimes it relates to something that I wrote and it will get mentioned on the program. But I keep a blog site. I keep it to maintain my articles in chronological order, and the simple way to access it is the way I do, Steve Ledman blog. All my articles are there in chronological order. I manage to cover a wide range of topics. There are many things that concern me, and where I go depends on the one hand, the various issues that concern me, and there are always new ones to come into my focus so I could add those to previous ones that I've written about. And then, of course, it depends on what is going on at the moment. So when there was strife in the Pacific Northeast, I wrote several times about North Korea and South Korea. And make no mistake about it, this was provoked. South Korea and the U.S. did the provocation, and North Korea was the recipient. I'm not defending the North Korean regime, but at least for the last 20 years, they have wanted one thing above everything else. They don't want any special favors. They don't want some of the things that have been discussed and promised by Washington in the past, and then the promises were reneged on. They don't care about those things. They care about one thing and one thing only: normalize relations with America and with the West. Don't meddle in their affairs. We don't care how a government is run. We don't care if they're... We don't want them to be too democratic. Let's say we don't care if they're nominally democratic. There aren't many that are democratic, really democratic, not by my definition. They don't care about that. They only care whether governments in place will follow the U.S. neoliberal line and imperial line, basically Washington's line, whichever way Washington is going. And if a government is willing to do that, including opening its markets to U.S. capital, that's key, then we'll get along just fine with them. North Korea could be our best buddy, and however harsh they are now, they could be three times as harsh. It simply would make no difference. You think the Saudis are a lovely government? Saudis don't allow Jews to come into the country, unless they happen to be U.S. officials, of course, or maybe Israeli officials sub rosa. They don't officially have relations with Israel, but there are back-channel relations with all the countries in the Middle East by Israel. No question about that. Maybe not Iran. Or maybe Iran. I honestly don't know. I mean, we hear all the smoke and fire and brimstone about Iran, but who knows what goes on sub rosa. And if Israel really wanted to be belligerent and attack, my guess is they would have done it long before this. So forget the rhetoric, as I always say. Only watch what happens. Follow events. Don't follow rhetoric. Politicians lie. They tell you nothing. Their promises are meaningless. You know that. Follow events. See what's happening. And then try to get information that makes sense out of what's going on to interpret it properly. That's what I try to do. I don't know that I succeed all the time, and I'm certainly not an expert, but I do try very hard to get as much truthful, factual information into the articles I write. And I always learn new things when I write an article. And my feeling is, after learning these and hopefully putting together a commentary in a coherent way, to pass on that information to others. And I must say, based on the feedback that I get from readers, I think I'm doing it more right than wrong. Oh, there's always some criticism. Usually it's by somebody saying, not telling me what they really disapprove of, but just making a nasty remark, like when I write supportive articles about the Palestinians. And I do that all the time. A brand new one today. What was my title today? I put out two articles today. I put out two articles yesterday as well. The one yesterday was Israel Hardens Repression as Palestinian Recognition Increases. Several Latin American countries have recognized a Palestinian state. It's largely symbolic. It doesn't really mean anything. But call it a small positive step forward. That's a big deal for me, even if it's only symbolic. There are five countries now, five Latin American countries that have recognized the Palestinians as a legitimate sovereign state. Let me see the way they put it. I mean, they obviously are not a sovereign state, but they recognize their right to be a sovereign state. Okay, it was a statement by Ecuador saying that its government recognizes the Palestinian state as free and independent within its borders since 1967. And it went on to say, sadly, the Middle East continues to face wars and violent events that have led to the death of many innocent people. Well, it goes on and on and on and on. This recognition is meant to reinforce the valid and legitimate wish of the Palestinian people to have their own free and independent state, having it as fundamental to achieve peaceful coexistence of the nations in the region through dialogue and mediation. Well, I agree with my Saturday guest yesterday, Ali Abu Nima. We didn't discuss this on the program, and there's so much to talk about. And I forgot. I thought of it after the program was over. But he wrote a book basically advocating a one-state solution. And I absolutely agree with that. We're way past a two-state solution. Most people who support a Palestinian state talk in terms of a two-state solution. But it literally is impossible because Israeli settlements take up... the last figure I saw was 42% of the West Bank. I think it's more than that. The separation wall, when it's completed, and it's still a work in progress, an awful lot of it has been built, but there's a good deal more to go. The separation wall is less about separation, less about security. Oh, separation, fine. Less about security, which was the pretext for building the wall in the first place. It's more about stealing Palestinian land, because when it's completed, it will have taken or prevented the Palestinians from taking 12% of the West Bank. Now imagine building a wall. Those who dislike it call it an apartheid wall, and that's a very apt definition. I call it a separation wall, capital S, capital W. 12% of the West Bank is stealing. So I think Israel is getting awfully close to having 50% of the West Bank, the best parts of the West Bank, because Israel has settlements and open spaces and military zones and commercial areas, all of which are restricted for Palestinians. They cannot go there. Tourist areas, Palestinians are prohibited from going there. These are on the choicest parts of the West Bank. And the Palestinians in the West Bank are isolated in separate cantons or bantustans. East Jerusalem is slowly being, I believe, totally co-opted. I wrote a recent article that I called, I called it based on the name of a plan. And my article was called Israel's Jerusalem Master Plan 2020. And that's what it is, a Master Plan 2020. And that's a plan for development of Jerusalem, East Jerusalem. It doesn't say that Israel wants Jerusalem exclusively for itself. But I don't have any doubt in the world. I would say it's a 100% certainty that Israel wants all Palestine, all East, all Jerusalem, East and West, exclusively for Jews. Palestinians removed, one home demolition at a time, one Israeli project at a time built, including commercial ones. And it's been incrementally going that way. The West, Jerusalem was reunited by the Israeli government, I believe, in 1980. And this was absolutely forbidden by UN resolutions, including, I think, going back far enough, ones that the U.S. signed. So this is cast in stone. This is law. There was a 1947 agreement before the conclusion of the 1948 war. The UN divided Palestine, divided it illegitimately, giving the majority to Jews in 1947. I think it was something like 56%. Don't have the figure in front of me. At a time when the Arab population was more than two-thirds or more than two-thirds, and the Jewish population was one-third or less than that, the UN gave Jews 56% of Palestine before the war, and Israel took 78%. Before that, 56%, and they gave them the best parts, the most fertile. I think a lot of the resources weren't discovered then. Mostly water. Water is an extremely valuable resource in an area that certainly doesn't have the water resources that I'm surrounded by. Chicago is called the Saudi Arabia of water, literally of fresh water. I sit very close to Lake Michigan, a couple of blocks away, and that is a huge body of water. Well, the Great Lakes altogether, fresh water. not as fresh as it was many decades ago. It's been so polluted over the years. And when I first arrived in Chicago at the end of the 1960s, it was not in all that good shape then. But just imagine how worse it is now, over 40 years later, with all the gunk that gets dumped in all of the Great Lakes, which is why even then I would eat nothing that came out of the Great. I think Lake Superior was the one lake I would eat something from 41 years ago. And then I became a vegetarian, so it was a non-issue. Been a long time since I've had any fish or any other animal products. But the situation in occupied Palestine is pretty horrific. But it's pretty horrific everywhere the U.S. Plants its iron heel. Afghanistan, literally, I've written a number of articles on Afghanistan, several fairly recently, and one citing U.S. intelligence reports that basically conclude the war cannot be won. And there have been other assessments. There is some generals on the ground in Afghanistan who honestly believe the war cannot be won. And that may have been one factor behind General Stanley McChrystal's so-called resignation. It may have been a resignation. What was in the news was that he insulted Barack Obama in the Obama administration. He was quoted in a Mother Jones article. I think that was really a smokescreen. I honestly believe he wanted out, no matter what he did, and he was hired for one reason, literally as a hired killer. He went over there to kill Afghan civilians, and I think listeners know what's going on. We have these, we have ground assaults, but we have this horrible drone assault on Palestinians, where literally, and I've written about this and others have as well, literally civilians are deliberately targeted. And the idea is simple. The idea is an insane idea, but the idea is that by doing this, we can separate their allegiance from the Taliban, I guess on the thought that, we're going to keep bombing them. So if they'll stop supporting the Taliban, we'll stop bombing them. But the more we bomb them, the more they hate us and the more they support the Taliban. Now, this was the exact same strategy we tried in Vietnam, and it failed. It changed over the years, had a number of different names. The best known is called Operation Phoenix. And I wrote several times about it. I use one estimate I remember distinctly in one article, that over the years, Operation Phoenix, I think maybe under its name alone, let alone what went on before that operation, killed 80,000 Vietnamese. We're talking about civilians. 80,000 Vietnamese. And the more we killed, the more they supported the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese. That's exactly what's going on in Afghanistan. Well, I concluded a long time ago, and I've written about this, that we don't fight wars necessarily to win them. We don't want to lose them. But the most important thing about fighting wars is to fight them. Win or lose. Win is a bonus. The goal is fight. Now, why do we want to do that? Well, that's pretty simple. Because the war profiteers want it. And the profits are huge. Look at the money we're spending. Hundreds of billions of dollars going to the defense contractors, going to the thousands of companies that make up the related industries, including technology and so many others. And they all profit from war. You stop the war, and their profits take a big hit. And now we have something that we never had until Dick Cheney began it, on a small scale back in the 1990s when he was in the senior Bush administration. Private military contractors. I believe, I've written about this and I forget the exact numbers, and it's been a while since I did it, so the numbers have changed, but I'll take a guess and say with all of our military forces in Afghanistan, over 100,000. There are more private military contractors, and there definitely are many, many more private PMCs. Many, many more PMCs in Iraq than U.S. forces. Well, they were scaled down to about 50,000. There are for certain over 100,000 PMCs in Iraq, and there are well over 100,000, I believe, in Afghanistan. Think of the cost of that. They perform all kinds of services, from belligerent ones like Blackwater to technical ones, technical expertise, to KP duty on bases. They do everything. They do a lot of things that the military used to do on its own and trained its own people and got by just fine before we decided to spend 10 times as much and hire these people so private business could make that much more money. That's what it's all about, giving more of our money to private business. And this has been going on decade after decade after decade. It goes on and on and on. And the latest example was the disgraceful tax cut that Obama agreed to, that will do nothing for most people in the country, but it certainly will do an awful lot for the rich ones. So it was a gift to the aristocracy, letting them keep the tax benefits that they never should have gotten in the first place, and harming ordinary working Americans by doing what I believe was thrusting a dagger into the heart of Social Security by cutting the payroll tax by 2%. I consider that a dastardly act because it's draining the Social Security fund. And I don't expect the economy to be much better a year from now than today. There's an awfully good chance it'll be worse. It could be a lot worse. There's no way in the world they're going to raise taxes on working Americans. So it was a one-year mandate in the law. One year drop of 2%, but I think it'll be extended another year, and the longer they extend it, the longer it'll continue. I don't think they want to raise it back. I could be wrong, but I don't think they want to raise it back because this is a way to erode the security of the greatest poverty reliever for senior people ever in this country, and that is Social Security. It's kept millions of seniors out of poverty. And I'm absolutely convinced they want to get rid of it, and they want to get rid of Medicare, and they want to get rid of Medicaid, but they'll never say it, and they'll be clever about it. The truth is that government is not our ally. Government is our enemy. How sad to conclude that. But the evidence is crystal clear. There simply is no doubt about it. And there's no doubt that it makes no difference at all whether we're talking about Republicans or we're talking about Democrats. Call it a one-party duopoly, or the money party, or the property party. The one thing it is not is a people's party. It never was, and it certainly isn't now, and it never was created to be that way. Way back at the very beginning, even the founding fathers, and they were a far sight better than anything we've had ever since, along with Abe Lincoln and FDR. But they certainly were not creators of this new country to support ordinary folks. Even way back then, only 15% of the population could vote. If you weren't a property owner, you couldn't vote, which either meant owning property or a business, or being a lawyer, or being a professional person. They could vote. Women couldn't vote. It took women a 100-year campaign before they could vote. And, of course, slaves weren't people. They were property. So those were the founding fathers, and they literally designed it that way. And it's amazing. The only way we know what went on in Philadelphia in 1787 was that James Madison kept notes. I wonder how many listeners know that. James Madison kept notes, but they weren't they weren't released publicly until he died. And then they became known. And some people wrote them up, including a wonderful man named Ferdinand Lundberg, who died, about 30 years ago, I believe. At least a couple of decades, I believe about 30 years ago. And he wrote a marvelous book that a reader of one of my articles alerted me to some time back, and it's called Cracks in the Constitution. It was written, of course, over 30 years ago. But he goes back and he writes about what went on in Philadelphia, and I managed to get a used copy of the book, and it was a find. It was an absolute find. The book is marvelous. I recommend it so strongly. Cracks in the Constitution by Ferdinand Lundberg. And if you can find a used copy, absolutely buy it and read it. But I wrote about the book in detail. And if you Google my name and the title, Cracks in the Constitution, you'll find my review, which is a very, very detailed review. And you pretty much know the gist of what that book had. And I did another article sometime after that comparing our Constitution, the way Lundberg described it, and the Venezuelan Constitution. It literally is night and day different. Well, anybody can read our Constitution. It's pretty short, and it's not hard to understand. I've quoted it many times. It's crystal clear to me. The only exception to that might be that sometimes they use language that ordinary people would say, that's pretty clear. You know, hello, how are you today? Well, maybe that means something else to them. And maybe that was code language for something else. Well, Jefferson used code language when he wrote the Declaration of Independence, when he referred to happiness. Happiness was a code word for property. We have the right to happiness. Well, not too many people have the right to happiness, but by happiness he meant property. But I think overall the Constitution is pretty easy to understand. If you want to read the Venezuelan Constitution, and you can read it in English. I haven't read it all. I've researched parts of it so I could quote an article that I've written that related to something I was writing about on Venezuela. But it's extremely long. To read it all will take some time, but the Venezuelan people love it. And I've heard, and I don't know how they do this, I've heard that they keep a pocket size edition in their pocket, but the darn thing is so long, I don't know how you get it in a pocket size edition. It must be one big pocket size edition, but it's got marvelous things in it. The government, which has an awful lot of revenue, mainly from its oil. Venezuela is at least the most oil-rich nation in the West, and by some measurements, it's the most oil-rich nation in the world because they have what's called heavy oil. And I once quoted the Department of Department of Energy in this country saying, "I remember the number because I got so many emails about it, thinking I was nuts." They literally said that Venezuela has 1.36 trillion barrels of oil. Now that's more oil than is recognized in total existing by all oil countries in the world. But it includes oil. It includes what's called heavy oil and extra heavy oil. And for some reason, this does not get picked up in the count. I have no idea why. But this came from our Department of Energy. Well, that will be developed someday. There's no question. Well, Canada has an awful lot of oil. They have an awful lot of shale oil. I'm sorry, tar sands oil. Tar sands oil. And I don't think that gets picked up. As resources begin to get developed, then they get picked up in the count. I am not a peak oil adherent. Every time supposedly the numbers go down, there are new discoveries. And just think about Venezuela for a minute. With all that oil, it's not in the count, not in the peak oil count. And all that oil in Canada that isn't. And there are some people who think that Saudi Arabia has heavy oil, but all the oil that's counted to them is the so-called light sweet. And by that standard, they're the richest oil nation in the world. But who knows? Maybe they have a lot that's not picked up in the count. And there are others who think that Russia is extremely rich with literally an ocean of what's called abiotic oil. I think it's true. Abiotic is other than fossil fuel. All the oil we know about is fossil fuel. Abiotic is not fossil fuel. And there are people who believe that there is an ocean of it in Russia. And Russia has been developing, I believe it is so deep within the earth that you need very sophisticated technology to go after it. And Russia has been developing this technology. I do know that Russia did some deep drilling in Vietnam not years ago, not known as a country with oil reserves, and they found oil. Not a lot of it, but they found oil. So many millions of barrels instead of billions. I honestly don't know how much it was. It was not a major find, but it was oil, and I think the Vietnamese were very happy to have it. There are rumors. I just wrote two articles about our Gulf disaster. I'll tell you a little bit about them. But in one of the articles, there is a rumor, and it's very possible that it's true, I don't know, that the so-called Macondo well, by the people who worked on the Deepwater Horizon, with justification, as we know now, they called it the well from hell. It didn't have to be the well from hell, but they called it the well from hell because BP willfully ignored safety precautions, fail-safe measures that absolutely would have prevented the disaster. I'll tell you more about that. It was in an article that I got out just a few days ago. No, did I get that out? Oh, yesterday. I forget what day I get stuff out. I put out two articles yesterday and two more today. Yeah, that one was yesterday. And I put out a second one on the Gulf today. But there are people who believe that Macondo sits deep below the Gulf, 30, 40,000 feet, whatever it is, sits on the word used, and it's in my article, sits on a Mount Everest of oil. What they're saying is a huge, why didn't they just call it an ocean? But not just whatever so many millions or billions of barrels that Macondo may have had. But if it's true, then Macondo has literally sits on an ocean of oil, and you can betcha that neither BP nor any administration in Washington is going to walk away from that. It'll just sit there for a while. Nobody will touch it. And then they'll go back after it again, not with the original well, but with another one. Not one well, likely a number of wells. But the disaster in the Gulf literally never should have happened. And that was my first article. Oh, something is popping at me. Let me just get rid of that. Ah, sometimes my desktop plays tricks on me. And it just was doing it, but I stopped it anyway. I put on an article yesterday. I called it America's Gulf Disaster. Accidental or deliberate? I can't prove it. And let me not be too emphatic, but I do believe it was deliberate, not accidental. And the reason is because of the evidence that keeps coming out. And the evidence confirms that the industry, because of years of technological knowledge that they've built up, especially BP. BP has been in the oil business almost, or maybe since its beginnings. British Oil, way, way back, decades ago. But BP, British Oil, BP, and the U.S. giant that that was merged into that company, Amoco Oil, which was based in Chicago, was a sole standing company when I first arrived. Now it's part of BP. BP has been in the business. They know good practice, but they systematically ignore it and don't practice it. Of all the major oil companies, they have the industry's worst safety and maintenance record. In other words, they don't give a damn. They want to make money. They don't care about the safety of their workers. They don't care about the safety of the environment. They don't care about accidents. And they have had a litany of accidents, some big, some small. There was only one when they had a major event at a Texas refinery that they got a modestly large fine. But for a company like BP, it was chump change, something like $75 million. They've had a lot of small fines. It's like you or I going out and buying a newspaper. It meant nothing to BP. Slaps on the wrist. So basically, it was official Washington sanctioning business as usual. Well, there are well-known fail-safe measures that every exploration everywhere can institute, especially in waters where it can be much more hazardous. There are fail-safe measures, literally, to make an accident like Deepwater Horizon impossible. Impossible. But the impossible happened. And why did it happen? Because if you could tick off every single measure that should have been in place, checked and working, which is what any responsible company would do, every single one straight down the line, no exceptions, didn't work. Everything that could go wrong did go wrong. In other words, the impossible, if the right things had been done, they were not. I call that willful malfeasance. That is a crime. That is not an accident. That is not negligence. That is willful malfeasance. And it's not the first time BP has done it. They've done it up in Alaska. I'm sure they've done it probably everywhere where they explore for oil. Everywhere, I imagine. Sometimes things go wrong. Sometimes they don't. They've gone wrong dozens of times with BP, usually minor stuff. Macondo wasn't minor. But I believe Macondo was deliberate for another very important reason. In 2009, the House passed a cap-and-trade bill. And I wrote a couple of articles about it. The cap-and-trade bill was supposedly an environmentally friendly bill. It has nothing whatsoever to do with the environment. It is a bill that lets polluters go on polluting. First off, it stalled in the Senate. So it did not become law. As much as the industry, as much as Wall Street, as much as other corporations wanted this thing passed, the Senate did not pass it. It stalled. The House passed it. But it literally lets polluters pollute. It lets energy companies raise prices. Oil companies, electric companies, coal companies, all of them. And it opens up, by some estimates, a potential $10 trillion market for speculative carbon trading derivatives. If that became law, and it was that big, that would be the mother of all derivative speculation, far, far greater than subprime or any of the others. Well, it stalled, so that the 111th Congress is gone. The 112th will be in. It remains to be seen if that bill will be revived. You can bet that the pressure will be very strong to bring it back and get it passed. There was another bill passed, and I mentioned this in my article, as for me, more evidence that the fix was in, but it didn't work with cap and trade. But it did work with so-called food safety modernization, and that bill did pass. It stalled in the Senate for some reason. Passed in the House months ago. 2009, I forget. But way back it passed in the House. Did not pass in the Senate. And then the Senate decided they would get on it after last summer. You remember the salmonella scare? The egg salmonella scare? I honestly God think that may have been, shall we say, a false flag. Well, I mean, they could easily get salmonella into eggs. I mean, people get sick. There's nothing false about that. But it's very easy to contaminate food. I mean, so much of the food that people eat is contaminated without even trying. So if you want to try and get it contaminated, it's very, very easy to do. And eggs, notoriously, if they're mishandled, are salmonella prone. That's why nobody should ever eat a raw egg. You've got to be nuts to eat a raw egg. Well, anyway, there was that salmonella scare. And that was the impetus for Congress to pass what they call food safety modernization. Well, it has nothing to do with food safety. Whenever you hear the language, smell a rat, it's all about giving agribusiness more power. It's all about hurting small farmers and small food producers. It's all about hurting consumers. And it's all about unleashing an army, an FDA, shall I call it a Gestapo army, to go after the small fries and leave the big boys alone. So this bill is extremely destructive. It never should have been passed. And I wrote about it several times recently when the debate was going on in the Senate. And there was a problem with the Senate bill, but the House rigged it to pass anyway. Senate bill couldn't pass the way it was proposed because it had appropriation language in it, and only the House can appropriate money, not the Senate. So the Senate bill was flawed. S510. The House fixed that by simply incorporating the Senate bill into a House appropriations bill, and they got it passed through the back door. An illegitimate bill passed in an illegitimate way. And that bill, before it went to incorporation in the House, passed by 100% voice vote in the Senate. Think of all the liberal, so-called liberal progressive senators in the Senate. There isn't a one. They're all fakes. They are all fakes. Support a bill like this? I mean, this is a horrible bill. Support a bill. All those Democrats again. You think of the names. I have an article coming out tomorrow where I name one, and I name four of the bills that he supported after rhetorically going the other way. My article tomorrow, I'll give you the title. It hasn't come out yet, so it's not on my blog. I call it Hail to the Chief, Spinning Obama's Presidency, because after he got his tax deal through, the media started calling him the comeback kid. You remember when Bill Clinton was called the comeback kid? Well, it was one article after another. Obama the comeback kid. Or do you think you have a right to call yourself the comeback kid? On and on. New York Times, Christian Science Monitor, L.A. Times, ABC News, Reuters, I mean, just on and on. It was really sickening, absolutely sickening. And I've written so much about the real Obama. I'll tell you about two more I urge you to read because I put an awful lot of work into them. And I did the same thing last December. But it just appalled me to read this stuff. So spinning the Obama presidency. So I simply had to have my say again. Very briefly, even though I had just done this two-part year-end assessment of Obama, and I put it in this article, and again, I got my own 2 cents worth of truth in, dispelling all this comeback kid nonsense.
well, comeback kid, it didn't come back for us. He went away from us, and he certainly came back from the big moneyed interest because he's taken very, very good care of them in 2 years. A year ago, I wrote a two-part assessment of Obama year one, and I called it betrayal and failure. And this December, I just put out another two-part article, and it's on my blog. Obama, the first one was called Obama Year One, and there are links to it in my new article, Betrayal and Failure, Parts 1 and 2. And the one I just put out is called Obama Year Two, Continued Betrayal and Failure, Parts 1 and 2. And I simply go down. I'm certain I missed some things because there's so much going on, but I try to cover the big stuff, including, I'm sure, some things that anybody reading my article will not know about, but it's in there. And I really urge listeners to read it. If you want to know the real Obama, go back and read it and then read year one and see exactly what he's done. And I, honest to goodness, scrupulously try to get my facts right. I know I'm never 100% accurate. Who is? We all make mistakes, and I found some that I've made. If it's something serious, if literally my take in an article is wrong, I would right away write a new article and correct it and apologize because somehow I got wrong information and I told the wrong story. So far that has never happened. But obviously there are mistakes. But I think I pretty much am on track with what I had to say. The key assessment is in there. What he really did, who benefits, who loses, you know the old line, qui bono. Well, that is covered in a lot of detail. Well, it's covered in abbreviated form, issue by issue, because most of these issues I covered in more detailed form in separate articles, and in some cases I didn't put too many links in. I think I put a few links in. I didn't want to put too many in, or the article would have been strewn with links. Nobody will go back and check all those links out. But you could take most any of the topics that are included in this year-end assessment and year one and simply Google the issue and Google my name and likely see a number of articles on them on healthcare reform. I wrote about that at least a dozen times. On financial reform, I wrote about it three or four times. On the Gulf, which is one of my sections, I've probably written 10 articles on the Gulf, maybe more, and I'm sure there'll be more to come. On Afghanistan, on war, I had a section on America's permanent war agenda, and indeed, America has a permanent war agenda, and I wrote a separate article early this past year. And I called it America's permanent war agenda. We literally have a permanent war agenda. We literally, to my amazement when I found it out, and I have a book documenting it, this country has been at war every year since 1776 with no exceptions, either at home or abroad. Literally, not one single year of peace. Several years ago, I wrote an article that I titled A Culture of Violence, that America's culture is a culture of violence. And I was referring both to overseas wars as well as the violence that takes place right here in so many forms, whether it's murders, whether it's rapes, whatever it may be. We truly are a violent country, and it's shocking. And it's why I just shake my head and say there's no way in the world that anybody examining the facts can say America is a democracy. Because we most certainly are not. But then again, as I mentioned earlier, we weren't designed to be a democracy. The first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, John Jay, said it as well as anybody. And John Adams, the second president, said the same thing in different words, that the country should be run by the people who own it. Well, it was way back then, and it certainly is now. And ordinary working Americans are simply left out of it entirely. At best, we get chump change, and all too often, we get nothing. We certainly have had our wealth taken from us, especially over the last 30 years. Well, let's say over the last 30 years. It was a different time before that. It began changing at the end of the Carter administration. His last 2 years, he turned from I would never call him Rooseveltian, but he turned more from maybe left of center to right of center. So he really began the Reagan Revolution. But people don't think of him in that respect, but it's true. So he gets more recognition than he deserves. They all get more recognition than they deserve, but some definitely were better than others. I mentioned Franklin Roosevelt again in an article I wrote about Palestine, where my title was, that one came out today, Palestine Today, A Reality of Justice Tonight. And I talked about the two-year anniversary of Operation Cast Lead, the war on Gaza, that began on the 28th of December, 2008, and it lasted about 3 weeks. But it never really ended, because literally every single day something happens. There's an incursion. There's an F-16 raid, killing civilians, bombing homes. There are snipers along the border, shooting farmers, shooting kids, picking up scraps. Our tax dollars support this. It's incredible. Our tax money supports this. Billions of dollars to Israel, latest in weapons. And you remember when Obama, in an effort to start the so-called, what I call, no peace, peace talks, offered Israel 20-odd of the latest U.S. technology fighter planes. F-24, forget the name of the plane, but it's the latest technology. I don't even think it's come off the assembly line yet. The latest technology, stealth, in the works with all the razzmatazz built into it, and the free, that you, courtesy of U.S. taxpayers, a gift, and Israel didn't accept it. But think of the irony: killer fighter aircraft for peace. I didn't see one word in any of the mainstream papers or reports that even hinted about the irony of that. But it really struck me right away. It struck me even more when Israel didn't accept it. The deal was to have a three-month freeze, but there never was a freeze. And the so-called freeze that was declared was not a freeze. It was a moratorium, but it wasn't a moratorium. So again, the language is deceptive. Forget it. The so-called moratorium just slowed construction a little bit, but it never stopped, and most of it went on. Maybe 80% of it continued, and then when the moratorium ended, it went into overdrive, and Israel refused a three-month extension of that moratorium in exchange for all these sophisticated fighters. Can you imagine that? Well, there's only one reason that I think they turned them down. They think they're going to get them anyway. You don't have to strike a bargain, because you'll get them anyway. You don't have to offer anything in return. You'll get them. And I think that's exactly what will happen. It'll be sub rosa. There won't be much said about it. At most, maybe a back page article in the New York Times nobody reads, and it won't be that long. If I hear about it, I'll sure mention it in one of the articles that I write. But this is the stuff that goes on all the time. This is our tax money. Instead of providing really serious needs filled here for people, working Americans are going through very, very hard times. I think before this economic crisis ends, and make no mistake, it's an economic crisis. First off, you can't believe the numbers that come out. They're so jerry-rigged. They literally are so jerry-rigged that whatever the numbers are, let's just say they're sanitized to look better than they really are. So you really don't know how bad things are. I'm convinced that they're worse than ever. We literally have the worst housing crisis in the history of the country. Before this is over, it will easily pass the worst of the Great Depression. Easily. And it could be years before this housing crisis ends. And I remember some years ago quoting a very distinguished economist who's now gone. I wish he was still here, because he produced some marvelous analysis. And he basically said that if there is a housing market in disarray. There is no way the economy can work. And there was a piece that he wrote that had a title something like, oh my goodness, the word beware was in it. Maybe beware a housing crisis. If you have a housing crisis, you have an economic crisis, and it's getting worse and worse, and home prices keep falling, and foreclosures keep rising, and people are in more duress, and yet the stock market goes up. Well, I wrote about that too, and I heard an interesting comment about a man who runs a service called Trim Tabs. And he tries to track who's doing the buying and who's doing the selling. And the comment that I read was that he couldn't figure out who was doing the buying. Because insiders are selling like crazy, and the public is not buying, and mutual funds are at historic low levels of reserves. They basically committed everything to stocks, or maybe a little to bonds, whatever. So they have practically no cash left. And he was scratching his head and saying, I can't figure out who's doing the buying. Well, I can tell you who's doing the buying. Let's put it another way. I can tell you who's doing the manipulating. And this is a known fact. And it came initially from a Reagan administration executive order that literally the market can be manipulated whenever the powers that be decide there's a reason to do it. And I believe that manipulation is doing the buying. So even though we have an economy in duress, we have rigged numbers that come out to make it look better than it really is, we have a depression on Main Street, getting worse, people are really suffering, record food stamp usage, the foreclosures and all the rest, unemployment. The real number is around 23%. And even the people getting jobs, the lucky ones, are getting rotten part-time ones with few or no benefits. So if they're lucky, and if they're lucky, they need two jobs, maybe three jobs. So again, the numbers are phony. And the only way a stock market could go up under conditions like this is manipulation. I wrote an article about that specifically, really going back and seeing exactly what the government programs are in place that literally sanctions manipulation. They let the big boys do it, and the Fed can do it. And this is the stuff that goes on that you don't read about and you don't hear about. But it will end one day. I have no idea when. It will end, and then if the economy is that bad, you can only hide it so long. And the Fed, there has been an awful lot of Fed money pumped into the system, and that does have some effect, obviously. It provides more fuel for speculation. But who's doing the speculating? All the sources I mentioned are not. So who's doing it? The insiders. They're the ones that are doing it. And they can manipulate it up, and they can manipulate it down, and they can do it one way on Monday and another way on Tuesday. They can do whatever they want. And in fact, that's exactly what they do. But these are the topics that obsess me, so many. Political prisoners is another. I could spend another hour. We're just about out of time on this one. I could spend another hour talking about political prisoners. I'm working on a new one, on some more people I believe were bogusly targeted. I've written easily on over 50 of them, and I've yet to find a single one I think is guilty. I think they are all innocent. All wrongly charged, all wrongly framed, all wrongly convicted and imprisoned, and they never did a damn thing. I think virtually across the board, in all cases, there was no plot and no crime, and it even comes out in the language. Whenever you hear someone charged with conspiracy to do something, it means there's no evidence to charge them with the crime. So conspiracy to commit terrorism means we have no evidence that these people plan to commit a terror attack. So let's charge them with conspiracy to do it. They don't have to present much evidence to make that claim. Oh, I wish I could go on. I hope you don't mind that I was the guest today. I will get Franklin Lamb back, I promise you that. This program will air on Sunday. This is being pre-recorded. And the one yesterday will air on Saturday. I really wanted to have fresh programming. That's why I couldn't bear to give this one up. So I decided to go solo. I hope you don't mind. Please do join us. And make us a regular habit. Have a happy new year.